Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the crisis on campus. We have two speakers, Dr. William Coleman, Associate Professor, Australian National University College of Business and Economics, and Dr. Gigi Foster, Professor, School of Economics at the University of New South Wales, and also, as you'll be aware, co-host of The Economist on ABC Radio National. So we're going to lead off with William, we're going to go to Gigi, and here on the occasion of the launch of Campus Meltdown, the deepening crisis in Australian universities, which is edited by William Coleman and forward by Henry Urgas, and I know some of the authors of the various chapters are in the room tonight. So we lead off with William, then Gigi on the crisis on campus. William, thank you.
Thank you, Gerard, and great to see everyone here tonight. Gigi and I would like to tell you this evening about a book that the two of us have contributed to, along with several other persons in this room. I see Michael Sexton, Paul Oslington, Stephen Javera, John Ludovic's back there, and Barry Spur. And it's a book about the crisis on the Australian campus. We present this book humbly, I think, as a piece of news bearing, or if you like, as truth telling. What we are trying to do in this book is to tear away the stick-on glitter in the sideshow pasteboard which disguises the Australian campus, to disperse all the smoke screening by the various lobbyists and politicians and media, to expose the fallen state of the Australian university. Now, when I speak of the fallen state of the Australian university, that's a statement of tendency. I really must acknowledge that on the Australian campus, there are indeed still remaining students who wish to learn, academics who love their subject, administrators of integrity, departments which are still alive, faculties which remain, which defend their teaching standards, and even a handful of universities which uphold the traditional remit of the universities. But those things, they're atypical. We are dealing with the typical Australian campus, AusU. And what we really have to tell you is a number of things which you may not be aware of. That teaching has collapsed on the typical Australian campus. In this particular, attendance has collapsed. And students aren't at home, by the way, busily downloading those online lectures. These full-time students are in full-time work, preposterously. So the vocation of the student has disintegrated. Research, I have to say, to generalise, is insignificant. There is a replication crisis, a refereeing crisis, and even a hoax crisis. More generally, research, I want to put to you, is affected by a faddishness and a slightness, reflecting in turn a general intellectual monoculture on campus. And thirdly, administration, or I should say bureaucracy, is rampant. I wonder how many people here are aware that for every two academics on campus, there are three bureaucrats. Okay, and that's an average figure, some are worse. And when I say bureaucrat and bureaucracy, which of course means rule by bureau, that sort of underestimates the problem. Rule by bureau doesn't sound too bad. But in fact, what bureaucracy is the rule of arrogant ignorance. Okay? And we see this brutally played out every day on the Australian campus. Finally, there is on campus, not always, but not infrequently, a febrile and even morbid atmosphere, where I'm afraid to say that the campus has become one of the fiercest defenders against free inquiry, a place of bigotry and intolerance, a place not of pride, but of shame, in other words. Now, how has this such a thing come about, you might well ask? Well, in my own chapter in the book, I tend to die most of the problem as essentially one of corruption. That is to say, there is prevailing on the campus a corrupt bargain between students and administration, where administration says to students, if you'll pretend to learn, we'll pretend to teach you. Okay? And both students and administration are happy for such a deal. This corruption, I suggest, in turns, is traceable to the conjoint operation of two phenomena. Firstly, managerialism. The campus today, I put to you, is an acutely overmanaged environment. Okay? It has become a playground for those who like to play boss, who like to play boss without the inconvenience of shareholders or an AGM or a bottom line. The second conjoint factor with managerialism is, for the larger universities, not necessarily the smaller ones, a great flood of money, of dollars, of silly, foolish money. And here I must pause to speak carefully of international students. If I was here 5 years ago, I would have said, thank heavens for international students. They are, on average, so smart, so hardworking, so esteeming of the value of education. What would we do without them? I'm afraid to report that over the past 5 years, connected with visa changes, there has been a sudden and drastic decline in the average, I stress, average quality of international students. A quality decline stretching across aptitude, preparation, and motivation. The most salient signal of this decline is actually in language. It's probably not the most important part of it, but it's the most sort of obvious one. So, to illustrate, I teach economics at the postgraduate level. In the past 6 months, I have been asked by some international students in the class, what does the word deficit mean? What does bureau mean? What's a corridor? What's a box? Okay. And really, this decline in the average quality of international students almost epitomised this corruption I was speaking to a moment ago. Really, the attitude of the university administration to so many university students is, hand over what you've got and we'll hand over the testimony. Well, so much for the sort of appalling state of universities. We might immediately turn to, well, what can be done? What might be done to remedy this appalling state? Immediately, I can almost rattle off half a dozen palpable actions which would certainly be improving. I mean, for one thing, be improving to have smaller universities. Australian universities, you may not be aware, are very large by the obvious standards by the obvious comparators of Anglophone countries. Possibly the best one is Canada. Canada has a larger population than Australia. It has 50% more people. It has three times the numbers of university. You know, why can't we be like Canada? Of course, one of the reasons why we're not like Canada is the asphyxiation and the obstruction to entry into the Australian university system. Imposed by a number of laws and regulations, but particularly enforced by this preposterous Orwellian Ministry of Standards known as the Tertiary Education Quality and Standards Assurance Administration. And the abolition of that thing would certainly do considerable stimulus to the quality and standards of the Australian university. The revival of the old staff associations, I think, would be a good thing for the quality of universities. I'm not talking about the union, right, this massive monolithic thing, but the old campus-based staff associations would give a real voice to academics. Some of you may not be aware, if you did university many years ago, you may not be aware that about 30 years ago, the managerialist revolution came to campus, and academics, the old god professor, is long extinct, right? The revival of a staff association might be a way of giving some voice back to the academic. There are various other ingenious possibilities. For example, one of our contributors has suggested, let's sell off the HEX debt to private owners. At the moment, of course, it's owned by the Commonwealth government. Let's sell it. Okay, so other people would buy it and assume, of course, the rights to the principal and the interest. What's the point of that? Well, one of the points of it, it would give a kind of financial discipline to universities. It would give a kind of share price to each campus. And as that the price of that debt, the value of that debt, rose and fall, I mean, that would be a good indicator of, at the very least, the ability of students to repay those debts, and therefore their employability and their likely incomes and so on. So, yes, there are a couple of ideas, good ideas, but I have to say, regretfully, that there's all, I suspect, there's an element, let's hope I'm wrong, but there's a distinct element of wishful thinking about such remedies. I'm afraid that's because they would be remedies, that they're not going to happen, that they're not going to be applied. There are too many people in the system who are on the take under the present arrangements, if I could put it that way. And too many who, I'm afraid, just don't care. And here we come to perhaps an underlying problem of the whole disaster, is we suffer, I believe, and this is not just for Australia, and most of our remarks are international in context, though they're Australian in particular reference. We suffer from a value deficit. Australia, the world, I put to you, for all its talk, doesn't really want education, doesn't really value it. Higher education, I'm not talking about education in the abstract, but higher education, if we were to put aside the genuinely professional disciplines, such which are really restricted to medicine and engineering and maybe a few others, but many so-called professional or vocational disciplines aren't so. I mean, how many people here are aware that for several years now, the great majority of persons graduating with nursing degrees don't become nurses? Okay, fact. I'd like to know how many, what proportion of legal graduates actually become lawyers? Okay, so the real, putting aside the genuine professional disciplines, which I suggest maybe medicine and engineering, I think the point of higher education is really to provide an experience of ideas and thereby the construction of a personal philosophy. And I'm afraid our age is not an age of ideas. It's an age of the internet, the algorithm, the computer. Okay, so, well, what does it all mean? You might wonder. Well, maybe that's the question which most people here are most interested in. I'm one of those people who do feel that Western society is in crisis. I'm one of those people who do sense disintegration, inversion, a kind of topsy-turviness, a flight from reality to delusion, from light to dark, and even from life to death. And I have to say that the university, the fallen state of the university campus, is to me almost a perfect symbol of that. But how much are they also a cause, and how much are they also a consequence of that crisis? I think, to be a little bit lenient to the campus for a moment, we should allow that the campus is very much a reflection of the society around it. Okay, the ivory tower fell a long time ago. And one obvious reflection of one manifestation of the fact that it is a reflection is the businessification of the campus over the past 30 years. Though I would prefer to call it managerialisation. But going the other direction, if the campus has been businessified, it's also true that business has been campusified to a considerable degree. over the past 20, 30 years. The campus is responsible. Possibly the greatest problem, therefore, or the deepest problem, is a kind of over-integration. I said disintegration, but a kind of over-integration. The various spheres of society have lost their distinct identity. And I want to leave you with the thought that possibly the starting point for any recovery of the university from a falling state is a recovery of its true identity. The Australian university should not be considered as a top export industry, even though it is an export industry and export revenues are welcome. Neither should it be deemed to be a piece of social engineering to secure social mobility, though historically it has secured social mobility and that's welcome. But none of those things are the identity of the university. The university, I want to suggest, is the place where young people, I do stress young people, locate themselves and orientate themselves intellectually for the adventure of life they are about to begin. And yes, I think if they had a sense of that, we might see some hope. Thanks. I'll now pass over to my fellow contributor, Gigi.
Much, William. That's very depressing, but also somewhat inspirational. Okay, I hope there's some messages of hope there. So I was invited, I'm very happy to be here, by the Sydney Institute, and of course originally by William Coleman, to contribute a chapter in his book. And the title of my chapter is Teaching Quality in Australian Universities, Present Measures, Politics, and Possibilities. So I want to take you through three main themes in what I'm going to talk about. The first is, why do we need a chapter on this, which arguably William could give a better argument for, given that he envisioned the chapter, but I think it's helpful to clarify the point. Secondly, I want to go through some of the political and economic realities that sustain some of the poor measurement of teaching that we see.
Okay, just so they can get a photograph of you.
And third, I want to talk a little bit more optimistically, perhaps, about what we could potentially do, given the constraints that William so articulately described. So first of all, why do we need this sort of chapter? So those of you who don't work in universities may not be aware of how we currently measure teaching quality. So I'll talk about that. But first, let's think about what actually is the objective of measuring the quality of teaching. So we may wish to measure the quality of teaching to try to judge whether or not learning has occurred in a course. Has learning happened in relation to the material being presented in that course, in relation to the horizons that have been opened by the student sitting in that course and imbibing the material and the discussions and the enlightenment that may be happening there. We may also wish to maximize students' capacity for further learning, and indeed for further participation in civil life. We may see universities as one of the places that tries to support and maintain the peaceful and sensible functioning of our societies through the creation of people who will be working in the industries, in government, and be stewards of all manner of different institutions which powerfully underpin our economy and essentially ensure our stable democracy continues. We may also wish to maximize process utility. Learning is fun, or should be fun. And when it's not fun, you know, maybe that's something we can improve without sacrificing learning to some extent. Of course, there may be a conflict between the transformational aspects of learning and the personal comfort of the learner. And then there are more optical objectives. One may wish to be seen to be a good teacher. And as a university, one may wish to be seen to be a place at which good teaching happens in some abstract sense. And these optical type incentives, which are not directly related to learning, arguably do reflect the sorts of incentives that William has been talking about. Another thing about teaching is it's very heterogeneous by student. As a teacher myself, I can tell you, and I'm sure William would agree, that it's much more challenging to achieve any of those learning objectives when you are facing a very diverse classroom. Because different students with different backgrounds and different initial belief systems and different orientations towards the world and different ability levels innately and different interests in the material, they all require different types of treatment in order to be enthused and to learn. And that's very hard to deliver, particularly in the modern university where face time is smaller than it was when I was at university, and indeed where many students endemically do not come to classes. So your opportunities to touch those people in the way they must be touched in order to grow, in order to learn, are reduced. And so the diversity we see in today's classrooms is essentially a big barrier to some of the quality teaching that certainly I remember from when I was at university. Now, what are the teaching quality measures that we use today in Australia? First of all, in most universities, and this will include Williams and mine, the ANU and UNSW, there will be surveys at the end or towards the end of every term, which ask students to rate the quality of teaching and the quality of the course along a number of different dimensions. Typically, the question from each of those two surveys, the course-specific one and the teacher-specific one, that is homed in on and used in policymaking, promotions, career discussions, and otherwise, is a Likert scale answered statement. Overall, I was satisfied with the quality of this course. Overall, I was satisfied with the quality of this teacher. The student answers on a scale of strongly agree to strongly disagree to that question, and then that average that you get from the students who are responding is attributed to you as the teacher, and that is then used in counseling you or congratulating you, as the case may be, for how well or badly you've done as a teacher. And that is basically the end of it. So that is in your course, in that term, were the students satisfied with the quality of your teaching? Now, there are also, of course, other measures of teaching quality that we have in Australia. One of them is the First Year Experience Survey, which is run every 5 years by the Melbourne Institute of Higher Education, focused on the first year of university, not throughout the whole year, the whole career of an undergraduate or a graduate student. We also have QUILT, and QUILT is a big one. It's done every year, and you get feedback from a very high level about the quality of teaching in different faculties and different universities. And that information is then filtered through to different faculties, and there is no matching of the data that is in QUILT, this experience-type survey, to individual teachers or individual courses. It's faculty by university. There's also the course experience questionnaire, which has a few questions about teaching, but not that much. That's done after students graduate, sort of what used to be the graduate destination survey. And again, we cannot match the answers on those surveys to individual teachers. Okay. So that's what we have at the moment to work with. And there really isn't much more. Now, you would maybe think that in today's modern age of data and technology that we would be able to leverage the vast quantities of information that universities collect on a routine basis every hour of every day from the students coming through and work out whether students are doing better or worse when they have been exposed to a particular teacher in a classroom maybe a year before. But that sort of merging and making ready of the data that universities are sitting on for analysis towards policymaking simply does not happen at universities in Australia. What typically happens with the data is it is formed into what are often called dashboards, which are cross-sectional snippets of what's happening at a present moment, and the longitudinal aspect of teachers matched with students over time and growing and learning or not so much growing and learning is lost. Now, one of the reasons for this situation is that incentives matter. As economists, William and I would never, you know, be shy to say that. And the kinds of incentives that are at play here, first of all, are career incentives of individual teachers, students' incentives not to fill out surveys, and universities' short-run incentives to attract and retain students. And again, diversity also matters here because students from non-Western backgrounds may be looking for something different. They may have different expectations implicitly about the bargain, the contract between themselves and the university, and they may evaluate the same behavior by a teacher very differently. Now, what has happened, I think, is very much a co-optation of the teaching evaluation process to suit the non-learning, the more optical-related objectives of measuring teaching. Based on many of these incentives, particularly by the university itself, because of course the university is the body that sets policy in regard to the questions that appear on the course and teaching evaluation surveys at the end of every term. So, for example, Oftentimes, universities will mandate the inclusion of certain questions that arguably don't have that much to do with the quality of teaching, such as whether or not technology is being used adequately in the classroom. That's a very common one. Many hot topics. Has this course been blended or flipped? That many things that you would not think are directly related to the quality of learning or even the quality of the experience for the student, but do tick boxes in terms of what the universities believe their KPIs to be in relation to how they look to their customer base. So often we also don't dig much further when student satisfaction is high enough, so we don't learn even from the good teachers what it is about what they're doing that one could potentially learn from and distribute throughout other teaching environments. So I'm going to read you a quote from my chapter, which may be somewhat confronting and maybe motivates you to buy the book. The recent meta-analysis conducted in Uttal et al. 2017 suggests soberingly that students' ratings of teachers are essentially unrelated to how much is actually learned in a given course, with student evaluations of teaching capable of explaining at most 1% of the variation in levels of student learning. In a similar vein, Nasser Abu al-Hijja, 2017, finds that students associate good teaching most strongly with whether they perceive the assessment in a course to be good, and least strongly with their own long-term development as a student. The title of a recent post on the website of the American Association of University Professors recently proclaimed bluntly that, quote, student evaluations of teaching are not valid, unquote, and went on to provide a withering indictment of the use of teaching evaluations to measure teaching or learning quality. This implies that if teachers who receive feedback relating to student satisfaction subsequently change their decisions about delivery, assessment, or other aspects of a course in order to maximize student satisfaction in ensuing terms, these changes may have little or no impact on the amount of learning that their students achieve. In sum, there are trade-offs. I'm an economist, I believe in trade-offs, in measurement as well as in any other type of resource allocation. And at the moment, the incentives that are facing the players involved with teaching quality measurement do not support the achievement of the deeper, more holistic objectives of measuring teaching quality, specifically those that have to do with learning. So more detail in my second part now about the incentives of these players. For staff, and William has provided an indictment not just of teaching but also of research, but I would say as a staff member at universities, we see ourselves as universally marketable overseas. We are internationally marketable. We can get jobs in other universities and other countries. And how do we do that? Not by having good teaching scores, but by publishing well. That is the reality of the career incentive of the tenured academic. It pretty much any faculty in Australia. And so when you are facing that reality, what is your logical time allocation? It's going to be to spend more time doing research and trying to get into good publications, good journals, rather than spending lots of time trying to become a better teacher. Most departments in general, when you get above a certain quality threshold, certain reputation threshold, certain standing in the world, will accept someone into an academic position when they have a good enough measure of teaching quality. They're not bad teachers, and that's kind of enough, whereas the research must be very, very top-notch. And research is extremely difficult and time-consuming to produce, and so logically, rationally, many full-time academic tenured staff spend more time and spend more mental effort on their research than they do on their teaching. So many academics whose research quality is above a certain threshold are going to rationally minimize on their teaching, and this further plays into the idea that, you know, those who can't do, teach. There are also incentives of casual staff, because there is no carry forward of learnings from a prior term when a casual staff member is hired just on one-term contracts. And so it's very difficult then for whatever has gone wrong or right in that first term to be passed forward to the next term. Now, in terms of students, obviously some genuinely want to learn, as William said, and I think often it is the good students who are frustrated by the emphasis on technology and flipping and MOOCs and all this new stuff. They just want to sit in a classroom in a lecture and write down what the teacher has to say, because that's why they're there. But, of course, you know, many people don't want that, and there can be an argument that some of our students sitting in our classrooms today are more interested in receiving the signal of having gotten a degree at a quality English language institution and are really not interested in the learning that comes along with that. And, of course, students of all types face the incentive, why do a survey if you don't have to do it? And naturally, universities' incentives. Their incentives are very heavily influenced by their heavy dependence on foreign students' fee revenues, which didn't used to be the case when the Commonwealth was supporting universities to a higher level. I have a bit of sympathy for universities needing to support their activities somehow, and if it's not going to be from Commonwealth support, how will they do it? But I could spend an extra 3 hours talking about what is going on in that space, what gives rise to the incentives, but suffice to say, the personal incentives and the institutional incentives of people who are running institutions do not support projects such as trying to better measure learning quality universities, which do not have a shiny brass knob kind of aspect without a clear business case. We see some of these universities' as incentives in modern, in fact, just recent traumatic news stories, such as the one about the Murdoch case, where Murdoch was sued a whistleblower, Gert Schroeder Turk, also in the UTS scandal of changing thresholds of entrance to STEM for bizarre administrative reasons, which were not well thought through, and even to a certain extent in the University of Sydney Ramsey Institute conflict, about whom I think actually the VC of ACU, Greg Craven, spoke here recently. Finally, what can we do? So I don't want to be totally pessimistic. One of the things that is very easy, should be extremely easy to implement, is to mandate survey response by students. One of the problems that we have now is that typically online surveys get less than 30 to 40% response rates. And of course, the students who are least likely to respond are probably those who had the most problems or possibly didn't have many problems, but you don't really know what the selection mechanism is. So we could simply say to students, you may not enroll in your next terms of classes if you don't fill out the survey. It's not that hard. We have compulsory voting in this country. We could do something like that. You can also ask more about learning. Value added. Has your interest in the subject gone up? Do you feel better prepared for later courses? Ask the student whether they think they've learned something. We don't often do that on these surveys. We could also enable more customization of surveys by teachers, so the teachers can ask things that are relevant to what they as teachers care about. We could even use measures of researchers' ability to communicate across disciplines, like the breadth of journals in which they publish or the degree of their engagement and impact, to have a second measure of whether they're likely to be good teachers in today's diverse environment. We could also, and I spoke about this earlier, invest in the matching and analyzing of data on student performance, progress, and survey results within universities. There is a massive capacity to do that, and it is the Commonwealth whose job it is to stand up and require that universities provide their data in analyzable form as a precondition for receiving funding. Finally, we could reward demonstratively good teaching and promotions, although this is only a local fix and will not overnight change the culture of academia. So I'll leave it there. There are a few other ideas that we might discuss later. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thanks to our two speakers tonight, and also I know some of the other contributors to Campus Meltdown, The Deepening Crisis in Australian Universities, edited by William O. Coleman, here in the audience tonight. So let's start with questions and discussion. I'll need one microphone for this side. And please don't stand in front of the camera. So if you two speakers come up here. Thanks both for your presentations. There are a lot of people here tonight, so we'll be brief. A bit like this. What about, I have no particular knowledge of contemporary universities, but what about the dropout rate among students? Is that greater than it used to be? And if it is, what would the cause of that be? And if it isn't, is it a false alarm that people speak about it?
Well, you might know the details more than me. There are some shocking figures. There are some shocking figures about the number of students who haven't completed a degree within 4 years of initial enrolment. Is that a bad thing? Well, it's probably a sign of something bad, right? It's probably the case that for many of them that they've wasted a certain amount of time on campus. Being on campus. On the other hand, they've also discovered something, at least about themselves in some way. I'm not sure what the comparators would be about how other countries differ or do better or do worse on that. I think certainly if there was some degree of upfront fees, students would take enrolment much more seriously, right? And I think that would improve the atmosphere more generally, just on the psychological principle that you value what you pay for. I don't know if you have anything to...
Yes, I don't have the statistics on it, but I would say a few things about the phenomenon. First of all, it has become more difficult since I've joined the higher education sector in Australia 16 years ago to kick a student out. So students will often repeat the same course many times and even have plagiarism or other kinds of allegations laid against them, and they still are not expelled. That, I think, is a problem, and that may artificially support the continuation rates. There is also the issue more broadly that in Australia we have these field-specific degrees. When you have a field-specific degree, you risk that a 17 or 18-year-old will not really know that they want to be a psychologist, let's say. They aren't sure, they try it out, and they maybe aren't very well matched. And I suppose as an American who went through a liberal arts system, I don't find that that suits every student. Some students it suits fine, those who are very sure about what they want to do and they have the time, they put the time into learning about the various fields of study before they enter or apply for university programs. But many students, I think, really are confused, and I think we may waste a lot of resources in those early years of the first programs that students do because of the nature of our systems. And so more broadening, I think, would be a very good thing.
Right, so there's a question here.
Paul, I was going to turn it on. I'm an economist too, so I love what you love the incentives. But this is really a specific thing that follows on from the discussion about measures of teaching quality. It seems to me that variously called attrition that we've just talked about, or student success, which has sort of an Orwellian ring to it, is increasingly used, especially by the Commonwealth, as the key measure of teaching quality. And that seems to me pretty problematic. Because often it's a measure. There are some bad stuff that happens that leads to attrition, but there's also the enforcement of reasonable academic standards that plays into this. Do you have any comments on the role of attrition or student success or various other euphemisms in this picture?
So I fully agree that student attrition rates are not a good measure of teaching quality, and one of the reasons for that is that there are many other things that color a university's experience that it provides to a student, including the quality of the administrative systems, the quality of the communication, the quality of the housing, the student's life aspects, and those things often loom much larger in the student's mind when considering whether or not to continue university. Then what is the experience in the classroom? So I think that's one of the problems. And oftentimes, even with the Quilt survey results, academic staff end up often carrying the burden of, oh, well, it must be you doing something wrong, rather than, gee, let's have a look at the institution as a whole and see if there's something going on more systemically that we could fix to try to improve those attrition rates. In terms of whether students, whether the Commonwealth should be looking at attrition as a general rule, I do think it's an important indicator of something. You don't want a lot of attrition, but again, there are institutional reasons for those figures. And without having more investment in the data that I was talking about, being able to track attrition over time and predict it, for whom is it happening? In what situations is it happening? We will be forever in the dark about why.
There's a question down the back there. You got the microphone, you got the question.
Thank you, and thanks for your presentations. My name is John Bell, and I've served as Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research at ANU and Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Academic and International at Sydney. I'm an optimist. I do want to endorse your comments, which at first might sound really quite harsh, as being calibrated and accurate, and how one deals with it needs to be given attention very rapidly. I do want to ask a question. Thank you. I do want to ask a question as to the positive or negative effects of the rankings cultures and how they could be used to elicit improvement.
Firstly, your comment is very gratifying indeed. With respect to your question, ranking universities is an absurdity. Now, I really don't know where to begin. Firstly, universities are a conglomerate of heterogeneous components. And obviously, A university will typically have good faculties and bad faculties. When the given faculty will be good departments and bad departments. But perhaps even more importantly, any ranking is a value judgment. Okay? You can't escape that. It is a value judgment. And the economists amongst us will also know about Arrow's impossibility theorem, right? And the impossibility of a reliable transitive ranking of anything, including universities. So there's a lovely article by Malcolm Gladwell of the New Yorker, which talks about these things in very accessible terms. But yeah, they really are a fraud practiced upon the taxpayer, typically. I don't know whether you know.
I would point, again, more maybe optimistically, to an institution that exists in the United States, which is the U.S. College Scorecard, which instead of having value judgments driving it, is based on market signals. So essentially it tracks the employment probabilities of graduates and the cost of the degree. Now it is done at a full university level rather than a faculty level, and I agree with William, it would be nice to do faculties. In the US, because of the liberal arts system, there is more of a coherence across all faculties, at the undergraduate level at least. And I find the US College Scorecard mechanism at least compares universities across market-based signals publicly on a website that anybody can access. That's, to me, as an economist wanting low transaction costs and non-subjective values, not a bad start. It would be nice to have something like that for Australia.
Thank you for your addresses. Listening to you in particular, William, maybe the title of tonight's talk could have been more about the disgrace of Australian universities rather than the time you gave. I'm very much out from outside the system, and so I speak probably more effectively as a taxpayer. And my question goes to the need from both an industry point of view and from a societal point of view, but particularly industry, where universities appear to be continuing to advance courses for monetary means to earn revenue, as opposed to meeting a distinct industry need, whereas, for two obvious examples.
We've got to be quick.
Yes, I will. The need for example, computer programs far exceeds, you know, or are the courses where they might be developing, you know, 150 graduates a year for two jobs. Would you like to comment on that?
I think, firstly, the university is only one sector, one part of the education system. Okay, and I think we also have to look at secondary education, indeed primary education, as failing Australia very badly. To some extent, too, I don't hear. Perhaps I'm going sort of easy on universities. We have to look at students. Universities will generally produce a course for which students want to do. Right? You know, they won't hold back typically. Right? If there's a shortage of computer programs, right, I would suggest it reflects a reluctance of Australian students to enrol in such programs, typically. That would be my feeling. I don't know whether you have anything to add.
No, I agree with that, and I do think that over the medium to long run, programs are created that tend to meet industry needs, and there are industry consultations on the advisory boards of various faculties. But I think the problem you point to is also a problem with the way that we negotiate the transition between university and work in this country. So if you do not provide a broader preparation for students in critical thinking and evaluation of evidence and problem solving and independent research, independent learning, independent work, then you are essentially creating a narrow graduate who can only really be asked to do the things that he was taught to do. Whereas if you create someone with those broader skills, you can place them into a workplace and have them trained there for the specific types of jobs or tasks that are necessary, and that person is set up for a better career for his whole life. And he is not dependent on simply knowing the software that happened to be in vogue when he was in university. And so I think that is actually a healthier way. This is one of the reasons I support liberal arts education and breadth of education at undergraduate levels, is I think it is a healthier way to create a more sustainable workforce. And the employers would need to then also, of course, shift to that new norm, were we to ever go there, whereby they get fresh-faced graduates and they train them for a period, and then the returns to that training pay off.
William and Gigi, thank you for sharing your views. I'm an educator. I spent 12 years in the field, mostly in TAFE, but also at Sydney University. But my long suit is marketing. I think what you put before us is that the whole education system needs rejigging. For example, I think it's you have a big casualty rate. What used to happen in TAFE, I'll take two examples.
We've got to be brief.
Of evening students. One is women rejoining the workforce who are outstanding students, and I don't think you were catering for any of those. And I think that also, when you take on an 18-year-old and he's also working during the day, you can change his life within 6 months because the boss hears.
Okay. Okay.
What changes do you see in the future?
So I'm not sure when you say you can change whether you're I'm not speaking on behalf of the University of New South Wales here at all. I'm just speaking on my own behalf. In terms of what can happen to a person when they are being trained at TAFE versus trained at university, certainly, as William said, I think TAFE and other higher education providers have a very big role to play. And in fact, I would say in this country, one of the things that would very much help is to increase in various ways that the government could help with the status of TAFE and non-university post-school qualifications. Because everybody who's in this room has probably had trouble finding a reliable plumber, electrician, bricklayer, whatever. One of the reasons we don't get good people and enough of them going into those educational institutions is that they do not carry enough social status. And the university degrees, in spite of the problems we've been speaking of, still carry more social status. And I think that's a travesty, and that's something we should work on as a society. There are various ways we could do that, but we don't have time to talk about them.
Thanks very much for the talk, which are excellent. In terms of foreign students, which we all acknowledge are one of the major sources, not by the fact they're foreign, but by the impact it's having. China now, as I understand it, having a foreign degree is no longer a passport to a very good job. A, because Chinese universities, a number of them improved significantly, some are subservient to her, some of them say so and now good. So it must follow that there is a differentiation there among foreign universities as to the value of their degrees. Would it not be appropriate for at least one or two universities in Australia to decide to make admission hard for foreign students in terms of their attributes? They would in fact increase it
Okay, right.
You've taken the words out of my mouth. I have thought that should be done by somebody. There's a niche waiting to be filled. I don't know why it hasn't happened. It's a business opportunity. I think really it's the short-termism of a lot of the university leadership that prevents them from seeing the value of that. And I don't think it's just a business opportunity. It is a business opportunity that aligns with what Australia should want from its university sector, which is higher quality education.
But it reflects just poor values. Australian universities had the opportunity, with this flood of foreign students, to both increase revenue and increase quality. I mean, to win on both guns, but said, no, we'll take this opportunity to reduce quality.
G'day, hi, thanks to both of you for coming today. I just had a question about the casualisation of teachers at universities and whether you think that universities have gone down that route more as a cheap way of catering to demand, and whether that's had an impact on quality, and whether you think universities are really measuring the quality of casual teachers as providers of education, and whether that's caught in some of the metrics you were talking about before.
Do you have a...
So I do think that casualization has happened. Whether it's possible to go with no casuals, I would say no. You do need flexibility, and you need to be able to service a course when someone gets sick or whatever. You need to have some people who are rotating in. I would say there's a positive sign in this area, which is the securing of more permanent positions for people who used to be casuals at university under monikers such as education-focused roles. So that's something that's come on board at UNSW just last couple of years ago. And it basically rewards people who are not doing research and are not expected to do research in their contracts, but they're doing more teaching and they're given job security, which is the main thing, right? And they're giving continuity year to year, which allows them then to learn from their teaching mistakes and wins and fold those learnings into the subsequent years. So I think that is a big step in the right direction, and there are increasing numbers of higher education academies and other sort of signals that universities are responding to a felt need by the society, by students, by the everyday taxpayer, for better quality teaching, more accountability for the teaching that's going on.
Some of the best courses, in my experience, are taught by casuals, right? It's because they're a bit different, right? They add flavour and variety and difference to the experience.
Hello. My name's Adrian Lacombe. For nearly 20 years, I was an advocate for the private sector in higher education. And by the way, the figure on attrition, I spent 2 days getting doing my heading. It's about 6%. It's flat since 2006. It hasn't got worse, according to the minister. The figures are pretty wonky. I would put to you that effectively what Dawkins created out of 38 universities 25, 30 years ago has remained the same, and effectively the Commonwealth, through not supporting students to make choices other than to go to the 38 public universities, effectively have created a cartel. I'm not the economist, the Commonwealth has not supported students who choose other than a public university. They're making...
Okay, we've got to be brief. Okay, so the suggestion is that the Commonwealth has not supported institutions other than public universities.
Oh, for sure, but it's the cartel which is behind it, right? So much of the regulation inhibiting entry into the university system is supported by the cartel. And so the government is responding to the cartel.
So what do you mean by the cartel?
Sorry?
What's the cartel?
Well, the existing universities in the unified system.
If anybody would like further reading on that exact point, there's a lovely book called Game of Mates, How Favours Bleed the Nation. Chapter by chapter, it goes through and documents the great corruption happening in Australian industries, one of which is higher education.
Yeah, thanks. As 50 years ago, you know, English 1B student at the University of Queensland, my compulsory reading was Crisis in the Humanities by J.H. Punk, so I'm wondering why it's changed, not a crisis. But something has changed, and I recall as a student, I felt the left of the university, in which I was part of the time, was in favour of free speech. And today I'm deeply alarmed at the reception, for example, of Bettina Arndt, who's spoken here, of Julie Bishop and others, of a general attempt, particularly in Sydney University and maybe other campuses, to try to shut down somebody who disagrees with whatever the young idealistic consensus opinion is of the day.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's been a complete revolution. As one of our chapters point out, all the disruption at Berkeley, you know, 50 or more years ago, the relevant student body was known as the free speech movement because they wanted to have free speech on campus. Nowadays, of course, it's exactly the opposite. They want to get rid of it.
And you're absolutely right. It's a poisonous trend.
It's
poisonous.
Thank you. Is the deficit in English language skills, not just with overseas students, but with Australian students as well, is that as bad as it's often made out, or as difficult as it's often made out?
Well, it depends on the faculty. Yes, art students can write much better than commerce students. I'm afraid, just talking about Australians for the time being. Look, it shouldn't be the university's job to teach them to write, okay? No, we've got 12 years, right, of primary and secondary education behind every university education. So I wouldn't fault universities for that. It's the secondary and primary school which is responsible for those problems.
I would also say there is less emphasis at many university courses on essay writing and long-term paper writing. Assessment has been reduced in many courses, going to multiple choice questions and short answers where you don't really highlight the English language capability. It's hard to assess oral presentational skills when you have hundreds of students in your class, for example. When are they going to do the presentations? There are innovative ways around that, but I think there have been pressures with the number of students and the technologification and the reduction of assessment that have pushed against our ability to really train students in proper academic writing.
Second last question here, but you've got to be very brief.
Yes, I was just wondering if there are too many subjects being taught at university these days. Would it be better if more subjects were taught at Tech?
The question is, would it be better if there were more subjects taught at Tech and fewer subjects taught at university?
Well,
does anyone want to talk themselves out of a job, in other words?
Well, universities and TAFE are very different animals, aren't they? Right? I mean, TAFE is there for sort of vocational skills. And you might say TAFE should be more promoted. That might be your argument. I'm not sure if it is. Should TAFE be made more important? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Well, yes, I suppose so, yeah.
The job signals would seem to suggest yes, but students are leaving TAFE.
Now, I have one final question. In about one sentence, what is the crisis affecting Australian universities? Summarise your view. What's the particular crisis?
Well, the crisis is the loss of knowledge of what learning is. That's the crisis. It's not a piece of paper. Okay, it's not a good job, right? Even though these things jobs are desirable, it's just a loss of the of realizing what an intellectual experience is and its value.
I would say it is also a crisis in the misuse and abuse of power and voice by people who are in positions to make decisions that affect everyone's lives and that are determining the allocation of resources from the taxpayer.
Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.